My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Tasmania is the birthplace of Australian whisky in the modern era, with unique positioning as the country's only island state. For some time now, its distillers have entertained the idea of protecting these attributes with a geographical indication or appellation, ensuring that products labelled Tasmanian whisky meet certain standards. Recently on the Drinks Adventures podcast, we met Cam and Susie Brett of Spring Bay Distillery in Tasmania. Cam is also president of the Tasmanian Whisky and Spirits Association. And during that same interview, Cam and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, talking about the GI for Tasmanian whisky and other industry concerns. I thought that conversation deserved a separate episode. And this part of the interview starts with Cam updating us on how many distilleries there are today in Tasmania.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I look back at the very first Tas Whisky Week event we went to back in 2016, I think it was. We hadn't even released a whisky yet, but we put our new make and some of our progress whiskies on show. And I got to speak at an event and I said, look, you know, at the time, I think there might have been 20 distilleries. I mean, when we started, there was about seven. So we thought we were doing something pretty unique. There was probably 20 when on this particular evening of the function. And I remember saying, look, I think there's probably room for about 100 in Tasmania. I mean, there's 162 vineyards in Tasmania alone, and they all seem to be surviving and thriving. And I made the comment that, you know, there could be 100 distilleries in Tasmania in the future. And I remember one other distiller came up to me and said, how can we possibly cope with 100 distilleries? Where's the room on the on the bottle shop shelves for all of this?
Oh, I thought he was going to say, where's the room on the island?
Yeah,
So I think, to be honest, I think there is about 100 now, not necessarily in production, but certainly in the pipeline. I think there's probably maybe 80 currently in production. And I usually take the last number I said, then add two each time we have a conversation on these lines. But a lot of those, remember, are quite small. There are a lot of micro distilleries, quite similar to, I suppose, in the way that Susie and I started, although we had a reasonable size still when we started. But I think there's quite a few distilleries that are only operating, you know, 300-litre stills or that sort of approximate size and just sort of making very small volumes of liquid. You know, they service their local markets. They've got an online store and they're doing quite well with their model and making good product, good quality. And for me, that's the key to our industry. We have to keep hitting that quality mark. You're only as strong as your weakest link. So we're always talking to our members of the association. You know, I sit currently as president of the Tas Whisky and Spirits Association. So one thing we're always banging on to is about quality. But, you know, we've got a great industry here in Tasmania, James. We've, one of the cultural things that Bill brought on early, and this was his experience when he approached the Scots for some help when he first started back in 92, he was completely surprised about how supportive they were and helpful of getting him started and getting the industry going, that he's always had a pay it forward mentality. And I think it's the responsibility of every new distillery that comes on who are getting help from other distilleries is to make sure that the ethos maintains throughout the generations and that we keep passing forward. And the other thing that I really found that was interesting, and I always recommend if you're going to make single malt whisky, go to the homeland in Scotland and understand the modesty and the almost the privilege that you have of making what I describe as the king of drinks being single malt whisky. It's an honour to make single malt whisky, I believe. And I love the modesty and honesty that comes out of the Scottish industry. And if there's one thing I'd take from Scotland, that would be it. And one thing I sort of feel that's sort of changing a little bit in our industry across the country, and it might be a reflection on the new competitive nature of our industry with the number of distilleries. I mean, I think there was 20-something distilleries at the Australian Distillers Conference, the national conference, when we first started, and I think there was 400 or more at the last one. You know, I'd like to think that people are still paying things forward and being sort of modest about their approach to the products. I do pick up a little bit of a cultural shift across the country where people are actually potentially putting other distilleries down and on the basis that it's going to lift them up. And that's certainly not how Bill introduced us to the industry and the culture. You know, he always says that on a rising tide, all boats float. And I think that's really important, I think, for any of those young distilleries coming through to start understanding some of these ethos around our industry, because there is room for everyone. Because as I said, we're only making small volumes. A lot of the distilleries are quite small. If you added up all of the single malt whiskey that's made in Australia and then doubled it, you know, we'd still be, you know, literally a pimple on the elephant's bum as far as world production. So I think there is room for us all. And I think it'd be really nice to see this sort of lovely culture that Bill introduced to continue on.
There's been quite a lot of debate in the industry, very much so in the last couple of weeks, just around the vagaries of Australian whiskey regulations. I don't know if you saw the article that was in the Herald a few days ago up here in Sydney. What are your thoughts on that? You know, there seem to be sort of two camps. One is we need stricter regulations, and the other is the last thing we need is more regulations. What we need is producers to be transparent about what they're doing on their labels and to call out those ourselves who aren't doing the right thing.
You know, what you're really talking about, I suppose, is carrot and a stick. You know, the carrot comes from having this transparency and the consumers understanding your product and rewarding you for it by purchasing your product. And for me, that I always sort of think that is a carrot approach. If you're really transparent and honest about your product, it will fall where it falls into the market and the consumers will pull it through if they think you're doing the right thing. The stick, you know, I think there is room for a stick and having laws. And I think also the laws, what they do for new distilleries coming through, it almost gives them like a guidebook of how they should go forward and actually helps them make a more quality product and something that the consumers will appreciate. You know, the rules are there for a reason. I know you can't regulate quality. However, you can regulate a certain process that gives an authenticity to the product you're making. And I suppose I'm speaking more particularly around single malt whiskey or whiskey in general. There is a beauty to the tradition of single malt whiskey making. And I'd hate to see that undermined by people wanting to turn a quick profit. But I think whenever you're in an industry that's growing rapidly and you've got a market segment that's growing rapidly, whenever there's blood in the water, there'll always be sharks. And I think the regulations are there for that sort of 0.1% of people that might be doing the wrong thing or trying to bend the rules for a commercial outcome. It doesn't mean that you can't innovate. I think innovation's very important in our industry, and we've got quite a few wonderful innovators here in Tasmania, such as Peter Bignell at Belgrove. You know, he's always trying crazy things, and I think that, you know, those boundary-pushing things are good for our industry. But at the end of the day, single malt whiskey is three ingredients. You know, it's quite clear from the Scottish experience, and I think the consumers appreciate the time and the effort and the fact that it's almost like a built-in degree of difficulty of making the particular product that actually gives it its specialness. And so anything that potentially undermines that and deceives the consumer, I think is not necessarily a good thing. I mean, if you want to age ethanol, put ethanol into a steel vat with some wood chips, as long as you call it what it is, and it's a, you know, it's a quality product, that's fine. You know, it's quite drinkable, but you know, don't go near the word single malt. Don't go near the word whiskey. It isn't that. And I think any move to deceive the consumer along those lines, that's where you need a stick. Now, here in Tasmania, we've got a set of rules. It's based loosely on the Scottish rules. At the moment, it includes bottling in Tasmania, which has become contentious with the growth of our industry. You know, it has things in there about we actually do allow for contract wash production, but there's a lot of talk in the industry about phasing that out because most distilleries are going down the line of making their own wash. It's probably irrelevant now, but it was probably quite useful when we were growing. You know, we've got these certain rules, you know, maximum 700 litre oak cask. You know, everything else is pretty much around similar to the definitions of Scottish whiskey, which gives it its credibility and its authenticity. But the problem is we don't have an instrument. We've got the rules, but we don't have, you know, other than me writing a rude letter to someone saying you're doing the wrong thing, we don't have that stick. But what we're looking at doing at the moment here in Tasmania is combining a stick and the carrot by using, we've got a wonderful organisation here in Tasmania that's mostly government funded called Brand Tasmania, and they've done a great work defining the Tasmanian brand. And we're in discussions with them about the development of a smart trademark, which not only means that you can wear that trademark if you follow the rules, it also tells the consumer that you are following the rules. And if someone isn't, They have the authority through the Solicitor General to take away someone's trademark.
And that's a trademark that's federally recognised,
yes,
for that geographical indication, Tasmanian whiskey?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sure, that's a smart trademark. They'd be owned by them, but what we do is we feed them our rules as an association, and they hold our rules under that trademark. So our job would be to come up with the rules, and then we hand them across to Brand Tasmania, and they'll smart trademark them for us. So we're sort of looking down these sort of things because, unfortunately, in Tasmania, our association sort of runs on a bit of a smell of an oily rag. You know, we only charge our members, you know, $300 and something a year to be a member. Pretty much only covers the salary of a part-time executive officer. We don't have a $10 million fighting fund like the Scotch Whisky Association with a team of lawyers chasing people down all over the world. So we do need an instrument, but I would like to think that if you've got the rules, you hand those rules to a new member, they can see quite clearly what they need to do to make a particular product and what it can be called. That, I think, takes out 90% of the problems. I think for those that want to avoid them, they probably won't be our members for a start. However, if they go anywhere near calling it Tasmanian single malt, we do potentially have an instrument that can actually bring them back into line.
What if they just call it single malt, not whiskey?
Yeah, well, I must say I had about 25 people send me that article when it hit the Morning Herald. I think, for me, took a note, make sure that we put the word single malt in there as well. That's basically a warning that we've got to make sure those things are covered. Anything that has derivatives of Tasmanian single malt whiskey in it, we've got to make sure that that's particularly covered. And for us, especially in Tasmania, you know, we are the Isla to Scotland, I suppose, if you like, of whiskey making. We sort of own that space in Australia. You know, we've got to get our elbows out and make sure, especially the Tasmanian brand is also protected.
I had Jeff Bainbridge, when he was CEO of Lark, on the podcast. This is going back a while now, obviously, but he did divulge there'd been quite a lot of controversy and debate around exactly where some of those lines should be drawn.
Well, Jeff's idea of a lot of controversy is he's having a different opinion to everyone else. It is really just a couple of larger distilleries that are concerned about the bottling aspect of the appellation rules. I mean, you have to understand that when we put those rules in, and we do have, as I said, we do have a set of rules that are part of our association's constitution, which includes bottling in Tasmania. That was seen at the time as one of those things that was really important for Scotland to identify their product as Scotch. And so we wanted to identify our product as Tasmania, so bottled in Tasmania at the time, which was back in sort of 2019 when we came up with this set of rules. There was only Lark at that time that voted against bottling in Tasmania because they had big plans to up their volume. And, of course, they're ASX listed now, so there's, I suppose, even more pressure on them to produce greater volumes for shareholder return. And there's a couple of other large distilleries that would be happy if bottling was allowed off-island. So we're actually going back to the membership this year with a plan to review these rules and, I suppose, really try and understand exactly what does Tasmanian single malt whiskey look like? What makes a Tasmanian single malt whiskey? You know, and perhaps that isn't bottling on the island, or perhaps it is, or perhaps what we do is we have a rule that doesn't have to be bottled, but those that feel that they're going to get a marketing advantage out of putting bottled in Tasmania on their labels do so. So we're actually going back through these discussions because we certainly don't want to be putting a handbrake on the growth of the industry because we don't really have the bottling infrastructure here in Tasmania that Scotland does. And I understand that, you know, when Scotland brought in this rule about bottling in Scotland, apparently they didn't have a bottling infrastructure either, but then they quickly developed it so they could actually meet these needs. Now, some of the things that potentially do undermine bottling on the island is around glass production and shipment. You know, potentially there's an environmental impact of shipping glass all the way from China or Europe into Australia, all the way down to Tasmania, then ship all that glass back to Melbourne for distribution or back overseas for global distribution. So it's certainly something that we're trying to work through. And we're in a dynamic industry. And so, as I said to Jeff at the time when he was CEO, I said, look, you know, we can change these rules as either environmental forces make us change or industrial forces to change. But at the end of the day, protecting Tasmanian single malt whiskey and making that special is really important. And so this is something that we certainly don't want to get wrong.
So did that mean that Lark wasn't able to be a member of the association in practice?
They did talk about moving away from the association or out of the membership with the bottling rule.
because it wasn't already in force, that was going to come into force.
Well, I said, we didn't actually have an instrument to enforce that, other than saying, you know, that you're doing the wrong thing. I suppose we've got a bit of a moratorium on enforcing the rules until, number one, we do have an instrument, and number two, until we actually go back and revisit these things, because I know there are quite a number of distilleries that are actually things like, for example, a Christmas advent calendar with, you know, Tasmanian single malt whiskey, that's bottled off island, for example. So there are a number of distilleries that are actually in small examples having their whiskey bottled off island and still being called Tasmanian single malt whiskey. So we're going to have to come up with some rules for these, and also an instrument of how we police it.
How long do you think this is potentially going to take? Because it's certainly been talked about for a while.
As I said, we've had the rules since 2019, but just not an instrument to enforce them. But at least that's helped guide the industry. And, you know, we have actually taken action against other distilleries that have been doing the wrong thing against those particular rules. I know there's some whiskey that's been matured off island and been called Tasmanian single malt. And that's under our current rules, that's a no-go zone. It has to be matured here on island and use Tasmanian water. I think we're probably looking at maybe a 6-month process to get the industry back together to discuss this and workshop it and make sure that, you know, we're actually doing the right thing, not only about the potential for our industry, but also the future protection. So we have to sort of look 100 years ahead, but also to the next 5 years at the same time, and try and find a balance that actually protects what's special about Tasmanian single malt whiskey, but still allowing our industry to grow.
Now, we talked before about the number of distilleries that are now in Tassie, and you were saying that a lot of those are very small. There are, you know, some larger players that are coming in now as well. Are you kind of comfortable with how the industry's heading down there with some more significant, larger scale players coming in?
Well, one of the best things I think that Starwood brought to our industry was a very affordable Australian single malt whiskey that got people drinking Australian whiskey. And I think those sorts of things happen when you get this growth and this volume. So some of these bigger players that are coming out of Tasmania now, and, you know, we've had some big distilleries here for some time in Tasmanian or Australian terms, but we're certainly seeing more of them, and some of the middle-sized distilleries are expanding into becoming big ones. Now, that normally has an impact on price, and I know that some of the newer players, you're starting to see some low to mid $100 bottles of 700ml whiskey getting put into the market. Now, I think that's probably good for everyone, because what it'll do is actually get people who maybe have felt that Tasmanian whiskey's out of reach, makes it then affordable. So people will actually start experiencing the category, and that will give everyone else a win, because if, you know, once they find that, especially if it maintains its quality, if they find, you know, Tasmanian single malt whiskey is good quality, they will actually then go and try other brands from Tasmania. So I think it's good for our industry overall.